This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Pleaded guilty to sentences that could get him 20 years. The government wants to go ahead and hit him with a sledgehammer and give him life. Jeremy Hammond has had a plead guilty to 10 years because, again, they over...
5 seconds.
They've over-prosecuted him. And Ed Snowden, really, to his great credit, has come out despite the sledgehammer the U.S. has taken to journalists and whistleblowers. And you have to be very, very proud
Michael
of him for doing that.
Ratner, we have to leave it there. Lawyer for Julian Assange, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. We wish the best wedding congratulations to Democracy Now!'s own Dennis Moynihan and his marriage to Patricia Schock this weekend. A very happy birthday to Karen Rinucci. Special thanks to Carolina Tamazama-Ripa for Spanish translation. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feld, Saren Mate, Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Malkoff, Hani Massoud, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gezder. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining.
Hi, this is Jim Hightower. Whenever I'm in Portland, I get my daily dose of local, national, and world news from KBOO, Portland Community Radio at its finest. And don't miss my commentaries weekdays during the KBOO Evening News.
Good in the Hood returns to celebrate its 20th year, June 20th through the 30th. Good in the Hood is a multicultural music and food festival featuring a parade, information village, kids space, arts and crafts, and an ethnic marketplace. Saturday, June 29th, Good in the Hood will be at Lillis Albina Park in North Portland with music, and KBOO will broadcast live from the park from 2 to 7 p.m. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in, turn on, and remember 45 years of KBOO history. This Tuesday, June 25th, from 6 to 7 p.m., it's a special monthly program focusing on KBOO's history to mark our 45th anniversary year.
This month, we focus on the Pacifica radio crisis of 1999, when a grassroots effort across the country, including here at KBOO Radio, came together to save the Pacific Radio Network from an attempted corporate takeover.
That's this Tuesday, June 25th, from 6 to 7 p.m. on KBOO 90.7 FM.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll hear about a bill passed by the Oregon House today to register growers of medical marijuana.
NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden turns to WikiLeaks to help him seek asylum in Ecuador or Iceland, although his current whereabouts remain unknown.
And KBOO brings you an interview about the recent bee die-offs and what they mean for the future of food.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 24th, 2013. I'm Nia Lewis.
And I'm John Rasmussen.
First up, KBOO's labor reporter Jamie Partridge brings us a report from a longshore solidarity rally today.
It's Jamie Partridge with the KBOO News. I'm out here in front of the Wells Fargo Center in downtown Portland. There's a couple dozen people out here in protest against the Columbia Grain lockout of longshore workers. So I'm here with the community organizer for this action, Latea Daly, who's the wife of a longshoreman, member of Local 8. And her sign says, end the lockouts. Latea Daly, tell me about your sign, end the lockouts. What's that about?
My sign says, end the lockouts. And then my other sign says, end to corporate greed. Shame on you, Mitsui Marubeni. Mitsui is United Grain, as most people know them as, and then Marubeni is Columbia Grain. And what happened is these companies, really since the beginning of negotiations, have prepared to lock the workers out, which they did in Vancouver in February, and they did here in May. They're really attacking the core of the ILWU union. Not only did they cut shifts, increase hours, but they also made a very aggressive move for the hiring hall. They wanted to bring in favoritism to the hiring process, which is absolutely not okay, union or not. It's not okay to have favoritism in your workplace. They also removed safety at the grain terminals, which is really scary because these grain terminals are very dangerous. Workers get injured even with the great union safety guidelines they have. If they remove that safety, we're going to see a huge rise in injuries, maybe even some deaths. These grain terminals are flammable. We don't want them going up in smoke. So this lockout is an attempt to break the union, to bring in part-time workers with no health care. That means we'll be paying for their health care. That means good paying jobs in our communities that support our communities will not be there anymore. It really would be a step back, not only for workers' rights, but also for our local economy. We should have good paying jobs at the ports. They move millions and trillions and billions of dollars. I mean, these companies are not hurting to pay these workers. The safety is important because the safety is what keeps the workers going home to their families at night. And the fact that they would just so aggressively want to take away safety and want to bring in favoritism to the hiring hall, it's really gross. It's absolute greed, and it has to be brought out. The Oregonian would not, they're not going to bring this part of the struggle to the light, because then people will see what it's really about. It's not about pay. It's not about benefits. It's about safe working conditions. It's about workers being able to get hired without favoritism, and it's about the companies stripping rights that the workers have had for 80 years that workers died to get, and it just, we can't let it happen.
And the workers are not, the ILWU members are not working these grain ships, but somebody is.
Yeah, they hired J.R. Gettier. They are a union-busting firm. They pride themselves on being scab labor. They are the ones escorting the scabs in. They are the scabs themselves. They have people operating the tugboats and the rail, the trains that are J.R. Gettier staff. They have a few people that are not J.R. Gettier staff that they escort, but to have these armed scabs be a part of the replacement workers is a very aggressive step forward in breaking unions and taking workers' rights away.
This is the first time it's happened in 80 years.
It's the first time I've ever seen it, and yeah, 80 years, especially at these grain terminals. You know, these workers have a long history. They have a huge amount of experience, and the people that they're bringing in, they don't have that, which is scary. I mean, any dangerous workplace you have with inexperienced workers is not good. And they're pushing this as it's something the company has to do to protect themselves and their liability or their livelihood. And you can't say that when you made $5 billion in the U.S. alone. It's not about them saving their company. It is about them taking living wage jobs, replacing them with part-time workers so that they can squeeze just that much more profit out of their workers, and so that they can control them so that the workers aren't organized. It's gross.
So the ILWU has had a picket line out every day, 24 hours, both at in the front of the grain terminal and out on the river. I understand that the U.S. Coast Guard is protecting. Who are they protecting?
The U.S. Coast Guard says they are protecting workers' rights, when in reality they are escorting the Columbia River pilots to and from their job. They are helping to escort J.R. Gettier to and from their job. They are interfering with a labor dispute. I thought Coast Guards were supposed to go out and save drowning people and protect people's safety out on the water. They're not supposed to be strong arms for these grain corporations.
So the U.S. military is actually taking sides in a labor dispute.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know if anyone's familiar with the postal workers' struggle when they tried to bring out the Coast Guard, but
it was actually the National Guard.
Yes, National Guard, sorry. But I think anytime you have the National Guard, the Coast Guard, you have entities that are supposed to protect American citizens. When you have them actually working for international corporations to hurt American citizens, that's something everybody, whether they're union or not, whether they agree with workers' rights or unions, they should be upset about that.
So if our listeners are concerned, want to get involved, want more information, what should they do?
To get more information, there's Longshore Shipping News. They post updates about the grain. You can get involved with, I think, Jay with J is working on it.
What's J with J?
Jobs with Justice. You can get involved through Occupy St. John's. They're working on it a little bit. You can go down to the picket lines is really the best. Go to the picket lines, talk to the workers themselves. And
where's the picket line?
The picket line is at Terminal 5, which is on Lombard. You can Google Columbia Green, and you will find the terminal location and the location in the Wells Fargo building. They're picketing at both.
Anything else you want to say to our listeners?
Yeah, when workers' rights are under attack, what do? Stand up, fight back.
Thank you, Latea Daly.
And the lockout. So Columbia Green, United Green, they're also known by Mauro Beni and Mitsui. They are international green corporations with billions of dollars in profits. They have their hands in everything from clothing to oil. You know the Horizon oil spill? That was Mauro Beni and Mitsui. Crazy, right? They also control a large portion of the world's grain. That means they control your food. Well, they've worked with the Longshore Union for 80 years in these grain terminals. They decided that they want to make more profit. They got a new CEO who actually promised his shareholders that they would increase their profits this next coming year. How are they going to do that? Well, one way they can do it is by replacing living wage workers with part-time workers, with less workers, without health care. That means we pay for their health care. That means living wages in our community aren't going to be there to put back into the community. So before negotiation contract talks even started, they prepared for lockout. They brought up workers, they hired J.R. Gettier, and the lockout.
As trains full of oil and coal are transported through the Pacific Northwest, energy companies have continued making proposals for energy terminals in the region. Whether or not the terminal proposals are approved, the Columbia region seems to increasingly play host to energy transport. For the past year, oil cars filled up in the Bakken Shale region in North Dakota have traveled over 1,000 miles to unload and port westward in the lower Columbia region. Tesoro has proposed terminals throughout the region to load the oil onto barges and ship it to West Coast oil refineries. Coal trains loaded in the Powder River Basin in Wyoming and Montana will pass through Washington regardless of whether these proposed terminals are approved. If the terminals are not approved, the Powder River Basin coal will continue being shipped through Washington to British Columbia, where terminals are expanding.
Another smaller bee die-off was discovered today in Hillsborough following the discovery of over 50,000 dead bees in a parking lot in Wilsonville last week. That bee die-off has been traced to the use of the Safari pesticide on trees around the parking lot. Safari contains a chemical known as neonic, which is connected to the nicotine family and has been linked by multiple studies to the colony collapse disorder currently affecting bees around the world. For more, KBOO's Janka Soderberg spoke with Zach Caldvier of the Organic Consumers Association.
I wonder if you can talk about the most recent die-off of bees. We heard about one in Wilsonville, and now another group of 50 bees have been found dead west of Portland, caused apparently by pesticides. Is this a common occurrence?
There's a growing body of evidence that makes it more than clear, abundantly clear. And this is why so many countries around the world are taking action by banning these chemicals or preventing genetically modified crops that need them to be grown in their countries from taking action, because the world is starting to realize that these insecticides that are created by companies like Monsanto and Dow and DuPont, the same companies that created Agent Orange, DDT, and PCBs, created these products, and we're starting to find that they are directly responsible, not just the only reason, but the primary one, that we're seeing this colony collapse disorder. Because these insecticides are injected into the plants, and they're designed to destroy the nervous system of insects that eat the plants. But it wasn't meant to kill the honeybee. But of course, what we're finding is this insecticide then comes up in the pollen that the bees eat, and in other ways, and now the bees are becoming the victim of the pesticide industry's malpractice. In fact, you know, our EPA just a couple of weeks ago came to the same conclusion. They said, yeah, there's a definite direct connection between these insecticides and the die-off of the honeybee, but we're still not going to take action. But other countries have not been so slow-footed. So there's an international body of evidence that directly shows when you introduce this insecticide into the honeybee's environment, it immediately has an impact. Mostly what it does is it breaks down the bee's immune system.
So if the EPA is in agreement that this is the cause of colony collapse, is there now action being taken on a federal level to regulate or to ban these pesticides in the U.S.?
Well, you know, this is depressing, I'll admit, but for decades, there has been a serious movement and effort by environmentalists, by beekeepers, by food safety organizations like ourselves, to get the EPA to act and ban a series of these insecticides that we know to be doing this to the bees. And in fact, Europe, the European Union, just banned three of the most prevalent insecticides that are made up of neonics. So we've had no luck, unfortunately, with the EPA. And you know, you can come up with various reasons for that. I think there's certainly a relationship between the revolving door of companies like Monsanto and our regulatory bodies. There's also, we all know about the power of money in our country. I mean, we're talking about an insecticide that's doused on 142 million acres of American food supply, corn, soy, cotton, sugar. And, you know, Monsanto owns up to 90% of the seeds that own those crops, and then they create that insecticide too. So it's very difficult, I think, unfortunately, for a regulatory agency to stand up to that kind of power.
Is this part of the Millions Against Monsanto campaign that you're a part of?
Well, there was a lot of concern among people that are also marching against Monsanto about the fate of the honeybee. And rightly so. You know, we didn't just come to this conclusion recently. For centuries, people have pointed to the honeybee as absolutely instrumental to our species' survival. Now, I'm not trying to sound alarmist, but there is no question that if we kill off the honeybees, we will deal a giant blow to biodiversity on the planet, and also it will create serious food shortages. And if we lose the biodiversity because of all the different plants and fruits that wouldn't grow without the honeybee, that has also been listed by the United Nations as the single most important predictor of whether people were going to go hungry in the future, is what kind of biodiversity we have. So there's a multiplying effect. So I would hope that it's not just people that went to the March Against Monsanto. It's everyone that should care about this issue, right, left, center. It doesn't matter. This is about our future, about the future of our food, and about the future of a species that has done so much for this planet.
Again, I've been speaking with Zach Colvier, who is with the Organic Consumers Association. You can find out more at their website, organicconsumers.org. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A new report says birds aren't adapting well to a changing climate and that the U.S. should be doing more about it. For more, we go to KBOO's Rachel Bennett in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
Birds are feeling the negative effects of a warming climate, according to a new report from the National Wildlife Federation, and they're having trouble adapting. In Oregon, that means the marbled murrelets on the coast, sage grouse in the eastern Oregon desert, and world-class duck hunting in the Klamath Basin are all being affected. NWF senior scientist Dr. Doug Inglis says people may assume that especially the migratory bird species have an advantage because they can fly to different places.
The opposite is true. They're actually more vulnerable than most of the species that are more residential in nature. Migratory birds face the unique challenge of climate change potentially affecting any of the multiple habitats that they require to breed, to migrate, and to overwinter.
Inglis says one problem with changing flight patterns and timing is that the birds show up at the wrong times for their natural food sources in those areas. The Shifting Skies report cites climate change as the biggest threat to birds in this century. Western forests are seeing pine beetle infestations, the report says, are climate-related. Nick Calero with NWF's Northwest office says that starts a chain reaction that ends up affecting birds.
What we're seeing right now is a huge increase in large-scale forest fires from that specific climate impact. And when these fires burn out of control, they burn hotter and they burn larger, we see a huge impact on wildlife and also on many of the migratory bird species.
The report makes some recommendations for curbing climate change, including more aggressive enforcement of the Clean Air Act, doing more to encourage clean energy development, and minimizing coal as a power source. The report says the nation isn't moving quickly enough to address cutting carbon pollution from vehicles or industrial sources. And Dr. Alan Wentz with Ducks Unlimited says farmers could be helping too.
Well, right now the U.S. House of Representatives needs to be passing a strong five-year farm bill that improves conservation of the land. There are a lot of programs in that farm bill that will help control climate change to all of our benefit.
This is Rachel Bennett with KBOO Evening News.
Wildfires in southwestern Colorado grew to an area of an estimated 100 square miles Saturday, while firefighters stated they remain confident they can halt the fire's progress toward the town of South Fork. Some 1,000 to 1,500 residents and tourists were evacuated on Friday, and town officials were unsure as to when they will be allowed to return. Officials were also concerned about an offshoot of the fire's proximity to the nearby town of Creed, whose 300 residents are under a voluntary evacuation order. The fire was spurred by hot, dry, and windy weather and was initially fueled by a stand of dead trees killed by an invasive beetle infestation. Fire officials say the wildfire is made up of a group of three separate fires. Although it has claimed no lives or burned structures thus far, fire officials have noted that the blaze has been highly erratic and difficult to contain. Colorado has weathered 12 wildfires so far this year, including the Black Forest Fire, which killed two people and destroyed over 500 homes in and around Colorado Springs this month, making it currently the most destructive fire in Colorado's history.
The Oregon House of Representatives voted today on a bill authorizing the establishment of a statewide registration system for medical marijuana facilities. The bill was passed through the Ways and Means Committee last week and was sponsored by Representative Peter Buckley from Ashland. Here's a segment of Representative Buckley speaking on the House floor today, followed by Representative Andy Olson, a Republican from Albany.
Mr. Speaker, colleagues, House Bill 3460 establishes a system under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program to license and regulate the estimated 200 medical marijuana facilities operating in Oregon today, allowing patients safe access to the medicine they need. The bill would require medical marijuana facilities to acquire a license from OMMP, similar to the license that patients and registered growers grow under the current law. H. Bill 3460 established new regulations the medical marijuana facilities must meet to qualify. Mr. Speaker, I want to call the members' attention to two floor letters that are on their desk, one from the Attorney General and one from the League of Oregon Cities in support of House Bill 3460. And I will make a statement, Mr. Speaker, that House Bill 3460 does not completely fix the medical marijuana program. There are aspects of the medical marijuana program that give great discomfort to many of us. This bill focuses on one thing: safe access to medical marijuana for people who are legally qualified to access medical marijuana. This will allow people to go to establishments that are licensed, that are regulated, and that are safe for them to access medical marijuana. In Southern Oregon, where I represent, the black market in medical marijuana is out of hand. The ability to trace with accuracy cardholders and growers is extremely problematic. This bill is going to give us a chance to actually regulate those facilities. If a facility is not licensed, it can just be shut down. If a facility is licensed and operating under House Bill 3460, a single law enforcement official, not 2 years of work by task forces and multi-county agencies, a single law enforcement officer can ask for a request of the number of cards, the number of plants, to make sure that the facility is operating within regulations. It does not cure every part of the medical marijuana program's problems, perceived or real, but it is a step in the right direction, and I urge an aye vote. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
If you recall, colleagues, Mr. Speaker, I asked the carrier a question earlier of Section 2, Subsection 7. Again, let me remind you what this says. A medical marijuana facility registered under this section may possess usable marijuana and immature plants in excess of the limits. That's what this statute says. Listen to this. You got to get what's going on here. This appears to be a very harmless bill. This is not a harmless bill. I find it fascinating that the pro-marijuana groups provided $200,000 for a statewide political race. Oregon is already home to a booming medical marijuana retail industry, where the state's estimated 54,917 patients can walk into a club or a collective with cash and walk out with cannabis.
Representative Buckley, you're in the privilege queue.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. With all respect, the comments about contributions to political races and even drug cartel violence, to my mind, go far away from what the premise of this bill is. And I would respectfully ask that the comments be focused on the bill itself. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Please limit your comments to the subject matter of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Think about this. Considering there are 41,752 growers in the state, that is nearly one for every cardholder.
The Medical Marijuana Registration Act passed the Oregon House today with all House Republicans voting against it, and all but three House Democrats voting in favor. The bill now goes to the Senate for approval. The state estimates that around $800,000 can be raised in registration fees for medical marijuana facilities. These facilities are still subject to federal seizure, despite the state's laws in place that allow them to exist for the purpose of providing medicine to Oregon's medical marijuana patients.
Also today in Salem, a committee of the Oregon State Senate passed through a bill that will provide some assistance to homeowners who remain in their homes during the foreclosure process. Here's a small segment of the testimony given in the committee today.
My name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the director of Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. This bill will fix a technical problem that will enable a particular foreclosure mitigation program that my agency administers to reach more distressed homeowners. This program is one aspect of what's known as the Hardest Hit Program, which is a program that came to Oregon a few years ago from the U.S. Department of Treasury. We've been piloting this program as a way to help homeowners in Deschutes and Jackson County who are underwater, and it's been very successful. This technical fix will allow us to serve more homeowners in those counties and three additional counties to which we've expanded the pilot. Those three additional counties are Crook, Jefferson, and Josephine. Just wanted to clarify, it does not require that banks accept a short sale, but it does say that they can't deny it if the homeowner is through the refinance staying in the home, which is typically an issue with a short sale arrangement. So we're excited about the program and the successes. I believe you've got a report that describes the program in some detail. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
That bill will now go to the full Senate for approval. While the Hardest Hit program does help certain homeowners facing foreclosure in Oregon, housing advocates say the program does not go far enough to help those most in need.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6 o'clock. Tonight's show focuses on the attacks against labor organizers in Honduras. At 6:30, the voices of those in prison and their supporters on Prison Pipeline. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is considerable cloudiness with occasional rain showers. High of 68 and a chance of rain around 50%.
It's 5:29 in the post-meridian. Time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It's been nearly 50 years since poverty in America was a front-burner issue on our nation's political agenda, and it's time to move it up again. Even as those at the top of our society have grown fabulously richer in the past decade, those in the economic middle have seen income stagnate and fall, opportunities decline, and poverty become not about someone else, but about them. Numbers that were not even imaginable half a century ago are now our cold reality. 50 million poor people, 51 million more who are near poor, almost 1 in 4 children under 5 years old living in poverty, and no sign of this mass decline decelerating. The face of American poverty, however, has changed somewhat. In the 60s, the poor had largely been born into it and were out of most people's sight, tucked away in backwater rural counties and isolated urban ghettos. This kind of poverty persists, but today's big jump in numbers comes from families that have been knocked down from a middle-class life, dismayed to find themselves among the long-term unemployed, grabbing at temporary low-paying jobs and buying meager groceries with food stamps. These are the new poor, but they also constitute a new demographic phenomenon, the suburban poor. Once the secure base of the middle class, suburbs have become the fastest-growing home of American poverty. Since 2000, the number of suburban poor has surged by 64%, twice the rate of urban poor. By 2011, America's suburbs held 3 million more poor people than were in our core cities. This is Jim Hightower saying American poverty is no longer about them, but us. To learn more about it in your area, check out a new Brookings Institution study called Confronting Suburban Poverty in America at www.brookings.edu.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Kids Count released its annual data book today, and Oregon is ranked 32nd overall when it comes to statistics related to health, education, community, and household economies. While most state statistics show economic improvement, that's not the case in Oregon. For more, we go to KBOO's Yoti Pulla in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
A new report that studies the well-being of children and families ranks Oregon 32nd in the country. The Kids Count data book, which tracks health, education, and household economies of children and families, ranks Oregon even further down the list in the economic category at number 41. According to the report, about 37% of Oregon's children have parents without secure jobs. And child poverty rate in Oregon has gone up from 18% in 2005 to 24% in 2011. Robin Christian with Children's First for Oregon says the increase in child poverty tells us that jobs are not adequately supporting Oregon families.
So what's interesting is that even though unemployment is steadily decreasing, Oregon families are still struggling to recover from the recession.
Oregon did perform better than the other states in the health category, which tracks birth weight and health insurance coverage. 6.3% of babies in Oregon have low birth weights, lower than 8.1% nationally. Robin Christian says the Kids Count report is timely as the legislature is making decisions about the state budget.
We need to be investing in programs that safeguard families through periods of economic uncertainty. Supports like the employment-related daycare program and also temporary assistance for needy families.
Kids Count data book published by the Annie E. Casey Foundation tracks 16 indicators of child well-being, including high school graduation rates. Among its other findings, it found 70% of Oregon fourth graders are not proficient in reading, compared to 68% nationally.
State officials claim there's not enough information provided in filed complaints to launch an ethics probe targeting Sherwood City Councilman Mart Langer and his role in facilitating Walmart as an anchor at a shopping center development. Residents opposed to the retail giant's presence attended last month's city council to voice their concerns about it and have since initiated a recall for Langer as the construction site property holder, which belonged to his family business prior to being sold to Walmart. Zoning changes in 1995 and 2007 were made possible by the creation of Langer Farms Parkway, an arterial that sits on property which also at one time belonged to the Langer family, is adjacent to the opposed pair of shopping complexes. For the recall to succeed, signature gatherers have until August 15th to collect just over 1,000 to sign, and there's also a petition at change.org which stands at over 1,100 signatures now.
In Texas this morning, Republicans used their majority to cut debate short and give preliminary approval to some of the toughest abortion restrictions in the country. Several members of the conservative majority had flyers on their desks quoting from the Book of Psalms. Democrats gained strength from more than 800 demonstrators who packed the hallways of the Capitol carrying signs reading, "Stop the War on Women," to oppose Senate Bill 5. The measure would ban abortions after the 28th week of pregnancy, requiring doctors to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals, and limit abortions to surgical centers. Supporters say the bill will raise the standard of women's health care, while opponents argue that it would shut down 37 out of 42 abortion clinics in the state. Cecile Richards, president of Planned Parenthood Action Fund and daughter of the late former Texas Governor Ann Richards, stated that abortion would be virtually banned in the state of Texas, and many women could be forced to resort to dangerous and unsafe practices if the measure passed. Democrats used parliamentary tactics to draw out the debate for 15 hours, pointing out technical mistakes in the process or trying to tack on amendments to fundamentally change the bill. Republicans remained largely silent until finally passing a motion to stop accepting amendments and to force a vote, a highly unusual and partisan move. The bill's sponsor stopped answering questions just after the first 2 hours when she got into trouble for denying Democratic amendments. When Representative Sinfonia Thompson called for an exemption for women who were victims of rape and incest, Representative Jody Lonberg explained why she felt it was unnecessary. Her apparent confusion about rape kits sparked widespread ridicule on social media sites. Loebenberg, who has difficulty debating bills, then simply rejected all proposed changes without speaking until the end of the debate. The Texas Medical Association, the Texas Hospital Association, and the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists have sent letters urging lawmakers to vote no on the bill, saying that it would not raise the standard of care. Democrats in the Senate said that they would try to filibuster the bill if it came to them on Tuesday, which now appears assured. Governor Rick Perry added abortion to the special session in the final 2 weeks after lawmakers had already taken up redistricting.
In Brazil, protests against corruption continued in dozens of cities over the weekend. Initially triggered by a fare hike on public transportation, Brazilians continued to take to the streets in the biggest protests in decades, even after the fare hike was rescinded. Protesters are demanding more government transparency, improvements to Brazil's public infrastructure, and an end to government corruption. Today, protesters managed to block off roadways to the largest port in Santos, which created a massive backup of trucks lined up for miles, unable to complete shipments. President Dilma Rousseff has inherited an economy that is lagging and is mired with inflation, and says she is trying to restore confidence in the financial markets for citizens who already pay the highest taxes of any country in the developing world. She has publicly expressed a desire to ease tensions with demonstrators while attempting to give confidence to investors by assuring them that the government will not raise taxes on the rich.
The producers of the television series Portlandia say they were approached by the FBI, who requested a clip of a recent show for training purposes. The requested clip is from the Sanitation Twins sketch. FBI personnel assured the show that they were not under surveillance, but that the clip would be used for its advanced intelligence courses. Here's a pitch piece of that sketch in question.
I'm Marcus Harris.
And I'm Madeline Harris, and we're here to tell you, Portland, about all the new recycling bins.
Guess what?
We're twins! You should say twins together.
Sorry, I know, you're right. Sorry about that.
And guess what?
We're twins! Twins.
Five years ago, we went green. This year, we're going greener.
Now there's a bin for everything.
For cardboard and newspaper.
The blue bin. Plastic and aluminum.
Black. Yard waste.
Yeller.
Is that how you say it?
Yeller.
Oh.
What do you say?
Yellow.
Coffee cups. Sleeves.
Orange.
Stir stick.
Brown.
Cups. Periwinkle.
Lid.
Fuchsia.
Oh, wait. It's a lipstick on it, see?
Oh.
Lipstick lids. Rose.
We did it.
The FBI did not say how a comedy sketch about recycling would be used in their counterterrorism training program. One of the actors in Portlandia suggests that the agency probably just wanted to use the sketch to make fun of Portland.
U.S. officials were reportedly shocked and outraged as former National Security Agency contractor and surveillance whistleblower Edward Snowden left Hong Kong on Sunday and headed for Russia. Snowden is the subject of a sealed federal indictment for his exposure of the NSA's PRISM program, the details of which he shared with British paper The Guardian and The Washington Post. Snowden's explosive leak detailed how the largest U.S. tech companies, including Facebook, Apple, and Google, allowed the NSA routine and unfettered access to the web traffic of millions of Americans every day. Also revealed was a federal order for Verizon to turn over the phone records of its millions of customers daily. Snowden was allowed to leave Hong Kong on a commercial flight by provincial authorities, who reportedly brokered a deal with Beijing to allow Snowden to leave, saying that U.S. legal paperwork to arrest him was insufficient for the Chinese government to make an arrest. Snowden arrived yesterday in Moscow, but was not seen in the airport. He is formally seeking asylum in Ecuador, who allowed WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange the same status last year. Earlier today, it was believed Snowden would travel to Cuba, causing a plane full of journalists to depart from Russia empty-handed when Snowden failed to board the plane he was due to travel on. Assange gave a press conference this morning praising Snowden from the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he has effectively been imprisoned by British authorities since June 19th of last year. Assange indicated that Snowden is in hiding and is safe, with WikiLeaks also providing legal assistance. Democracy activist and author Norman Solomon spoke this morning on KBOO's Air Cascadia about the implications of the case.
Well, the speculation about where he is headed is just that, it's speculation. But certainly when you have the United States government and its various intelligence agencies and diplomatic clout on your tail, maybe a little smoke and mirrors is helpful. Clearly, Edward Snowden has exposed to the light of day tremendous amount of information that the people at the top of the U.S. government, executive and legislative branch, just don't want the American people to know. And I think that's really among the very crucial points here, that you can't have consent of the governed when the governed don't have basic information about what's being done in their names with their tax dollars. That is our situation. And although he was, I think, overly cautious compared to what conscience and the Constitution would call for, Senator Ron Wyden has been conspicuous, along with Senator Udall, for actually raising concerns in the last couple of years about how the so-called Patriot Act was actually being implemented by the U.S. government. And it's very conspicuous now about the need for people to speak up and to raise these crucial points at the very time that Edward Snowden is being pursued. And I'd like to mention to all cable listeners that since last night, more than 20,000 people have gone to the website of rootsaction.org, which is an action arm for progressive movements that I co-founded with my colleague Jeff Cohen, the founder of FAIR, the Media Watch group, which of course produces Counterspin, heard on KBOO. And people have been signing up and sending emails, it takes about a minute, to President Obama saying, "Hands off Edward Snowden. Don't interfere with his journey for political asylum." And so I'd like to invite everybody now to take a minute, go to rootsaction.org, and just send your message. We have to be heard. And I also would urge you, whether your congressperson is Mr. Blumenauer or anybody else, make your voices heard, because members of Congress are basically leaving it to the Obama administration to track down Edward Snowden and to do to him what has been done essentially to Bradley Manning, and that's to put him up behind walls in solitary so that his voice can no longer be heard. And it's very important to us to organize to prevent that from happening.
That was Norman Solomon speaking on KBOO this morning. An Ecuadorian state official said that the country is currently considering Snowden's asylum application.
As the country of Ecuador offers to provide asylum to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, the Central American nation is itself coming under fire for a new law that some journalists say amounts to censorship of their work. The new communications law is modeled on a similar one in Venezuela, which establishes national regulations of editorial content and gives authorities the power to censor the press. In Venezuela, the privately owned media plays a key role in the coup d'etat that attempted to overthrow elected President Hugo Chavez in 2002. That coup was led by the Venezuelan Chamber of Commerce with support from the U.S. government. Chavez was removed from office and held prisoner for 48 hours, during which time the private media reported false information and then refused to broadcast any news on the situation at all after large-scale protests broke out in support of Chavez. In response, late Hugo Chavez then created a national community media network to try to counteract the power of the small number of private companies controlling Venezuela's media. He urged the Congress to pass a communications bill which, like the one recently passed in Ecuador, outlaws so-called media lynching, which the law stated was having negative effects on a person or institution's image without sufficient evidence. In the U.S., there are similar laws against libel or publishing false information in an attempt to damage someone's reputation. The Committee to Protect Journalists has criticized the new law in Ecuador, saying that the restrictive provisions and vague language of this legislation run counter to international standards on freedom of expression.
U.S. Senator for Oregon Ron Wyden is leading an effort to challenge the National Security Agency's inaccurate portrayal of its widespread surveillance operation recently exposed by Edward Snowden. Wyden is joined by Senator Mark Udall from Colorado in a push for greater transparency and corrections of past inaccuracies from the NSA. Both senators are on the Intelligence Committee and thus have access to secret information that has not been made public. In a demonstration of the continued secrecy surrounding NSA operations, the two senators said that they could not publicly identify the allegedly misleading section or sections of a fact sheet without compromising classified.